When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Today I have something special for you. This is a collaborative project put together with fellow true crime creator TZ Borden. If you don't already know, TZ Borden is the host and creator of the excellent Tapes from the Dark Side podcast, a fully independent investigative podcast that takes you down the darkest roads the genre has on offer. When he asked me to collaborate on this project, I couldn't resist. And what is this episode about? It's about Peter Sotos, potentially the single most controversial figure in true crime. A godfather of the genre, he pushed the boundaries in ways that makes even yours truly uncomfortable. And I can't even say that I fully condone the lengths Peter Sotos has gone. TZ Borden aptly titled the episode, Modern Desaad. What you're going to hear is an expertly edited episode crafted by Mr. Borden, which runs for over 90 minutes. Much of the episode features a conversation between myself and TZ. And if you like what you hear, go and subscribe to TZ Borden. You won't regret it. Remember, his podcast is called Tapes from the Dark Side, not Tales. But his stuff does get dark. You've been warned. With this introduction out of the way, let's get to today's episode on one of the true crime genre's criminally undercovered figures. If you call yourself a fan of the genre, you owe it to yourself to listen and pay close attention. All right, let's get on with it. Obscura and Tapes from the Dark Side presents Modern Desaad, a conversation on Peter Sotos.
He asked if I wanted to stop by a mutual friend of ours' house because he wanted to pick up some cocaine. And he said, sure. He asked me if I wanted to go up. He knew it had been a long time since I'd seen Peter. He parked the car and we went up there and he had six of his friends waiting for me. I remember them, like, having sex with me. I don't remember them hurting me, like, physically beating me or anything like that. I guess after, like, the third or fourth one, I passed out. And when I came to, they had put me in his wife's running path in the park and left me there. She loaded me up in her car and took me to a hotel room. One of her friends was a doctor and he came over and checked me out. She got round-the-clock nurses and bodyguards for me. Like 3 weeks later, my eyes got to where I could see. They were still all black and blue, but they weren't swollen shut anymore.
Tapes from the dark side contains descriptions of violence and sexuality. Darkness, my old friend. Listener discretion is advised.
to the mixtape. My name is TZ. I'm your host. This week we have a raw talk with Justin Drown, who hosts the podcast Obscura. In talking with Justin about his podcast, one of the people he brought up was a man named Peter Sotos, a person I had never heard of. Even though I've more than dipped my toes in the true crime genre, I tend to hyper-focus on one case, and so I don't consider myself a jack of all trades when it comes to true crime. And Peter Sotos is one of those probably many individuals who I had simply never heard of. But now that I'm acquainted with them, I've become fascinated with them and their approach to the genre, probably one of the most unique approaches I've ever come across. Peter Sotos began writing about crime in the 1980s. His first publication, called Pure, in 1984, was the subject of much controversy. In it, he takes a first-person point of view of the sexual predator or rapist or killer, exploring their thoughts in depth in the most raw format I've ever come across. I'm a bit of a horror movie junkie. I'm also a bit of a crime documentary junkie. And nothing in those two genres, I don't think I've ever seen, aside from maybe one or two horror movies, comes close to Peter Sotos' writing. It's the most visceral, powerful writing I've ever read. And so after tracking down Pure and reading a few of the magazines, I immediately ran back to Justin and wanted to discuss it with him. And I think the best way you could characterize it is by a novice asking someone a little more introduced, you could say. Although I think Justin himself would tell you he's not an expert on Sotos. He's definitely read more of him than I have. So a lot of my questions might come across as naive. Basically, the perspective of somebody who has just discovered the artist and is asking all the questions that have popped up in their head. Now, I do want to say Pure is not the only work that Peter Sotos created. In fact, he's got dozens of entries in his name. In particular, his critiques of the true crime genre were also extremely powerful to me. He has a total disdain for true crime content that is dishonest. And some of his reviews that I've read of crime documentaries, TV specials, and that kind of thing, he just absolutely skewers these people. It's entertaining. It's also kind of refreshing. But there's also just a very deep level of pessimism, of darkness. There's a certain tone in Peter Sotos' writing that is a little bit overwhelming for my personal taste. And I think that might be kind of the point. But I don't want to ramble on too much. I'd rather just play for you my conversation with Justin. I forgot to say, too, the clip that you heard in the beginning of this episode is from an album called Buyer's Market. It was released in 1992. And is basically just a spoken word collage of victim statements. After my talk with Justin ends, I'll play a speech by Peter Sotos, which is one of the first things that got me interested in him. It's him talking at the Pompidou Center in 2012 in Paris. And one last thing I do want to say, if you do decide to seek out Peter Sotos' work, please make sure you're in the right state of mind. It's arguably more graphic than anything I've ever featured on Tapes from the Dark Side. I've listened to most of Justin's episodes, and it's probably more graphic than anything he's had on his show. Although maybe not Black Label. If you've heard Black Label, you know what I'm talking about. Anyways, thank you to Justin Drown for recording this with me and humoring me. And now, here's Justin Drown. Here with Justin Drown to talk about one of the most infamous personalities in the true crime world, Peter Sotos, who I was unfamiliar with until Justin mentioned him in our last interview for the True Crime Pod Presents. And I was curious, so I looked him up and I was trying to think of my first gut take reaction when I first encountered Peter Sotos was fascination, disgust, and I would also say respect from my end. But I want to get, you know, I've only known about Peter Sotos for about a week now, and I've been reading his stuff and listening to some of his stuff. But could, Justin, could you tell us how you came across Peter Sotos?
Yeah, sure. So my friends and I, we've always had an interest in exploring different music genres. And he had been getting into various noise music. And this was years ago. I mean, I want to say about a decade ago. And through happenstance, he happened upon Peter Sotos, who, he was involved with, I believe the band's called White House, as well as, you know, and we're going to get into this, you know, his other projects that usually are at the very least true crime or voyeurism adjacent. And, you know, he told me of this CD. He's like, yeah, I just heard, you know, the absolute worst, the worst thing in history, you know, called Buyer's Market. And it's even on YouTube. And, you know, I lasted 2 minutes of skimming through it before, like, turning it off in, like, disgust. That piqued my interest, you know, being, like, 25 at the time. And later that night, I tracked it down. And I think a lot of people in true crime, they have this similar experience. I sort of found myself falling down a rabbit hole. And so for the next, you know, couple hours that night before bed, I was just laying there and sort of listening to various Peter Sotos projects, as well as reading PDFs online and things like that. And I think it's worth noting, too, for anyone listening to this, before you hit pause, you know, we kind of should actually preface any further discussion by saying that you should be very careful when seeking out Peter Sotos content, because, yeah, the content I ended up finding was very extreme. There was definitely a feeling of, you know, disgust and horror that I felt, as well as a fascination and even a begrudging, you know, respect. And so, yeah, I guess, yeah, when I was 25, that's sort of how I found myself discovering Peter Sotos.
I was just looking through a PDF because I did the same thing where I found a torrent of all his PDFs. And there's this one called The Eye, or just called Eye. I guess it's a piece about him by Sam Gaines. And one of the quotes from it says, "Beyond good and evil, beyond love and hate, Peter Sotos writes at the intersection of sex, brutality, and crime in the most immediate sense those words could ever hope to imply." And then it goes on. It's just, I think that's an understatement. Even you can't really put into words how disturbing his writing is. I, you know, being interested in true crime, I thought I had read and heard the worst. But I was wrong. I think this is truly beyond what anything I've ever encountered. And so I want to echo what Justin says. Like, if you're interested in hearing us talk about it, that's one thing, but be very cautious. His writing is very, like, beyond extreme. It's the most intense stuff I've ever read in my life. And, you know, not because of the extremity, but one of his pictures, I guess we should talk about his controversy and his, I think it was on his second issue of, was it Pure that got him in, landed him in jail?
Yes, it was Pure. I believe it was in 1985. He was initially arrested for obscenity. Upon searching his house, you know, there's really no other way to put it, they found images of child pornography that were meant I from what I gather, you know, he was altering the images to then use for the magazine. And yeah, that caught him with a child pornography charge. And I think that, you know, it's worth stopping and noting as well. When it comes to art in general, being fascinated with art or an artist or even being influenced to some degree isn't necessarily signing on everything they've done. Because as well, you know, I will be the first to say it. Peter Soto, he crosses the line a little too often for my taste. So that is worth noting. So yes, he was, I believe it was it 85 he was arrested?
That sounds right. I'm actually not sure. But yeah, you know, you brought up too that he kind of reminded you, and actually this article that I was talking about, the modern day Desaad, who was that the guy the 120 Days of Sodom was written by, the novel?
Yeah, so there's also an excellent movie called Quills, I think, with Jeffrey Rush.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. I always think of the movie 120 Days of Sodom.
Oh yeah, yeah, saw that on Criterion back in the day. But I do think that there are definitely comparisons to be made, especially because he's brought up Marquis de Sade himself several times in interviews, and even in a recent interview, he was talking about Jamie Gillis, someone who I think was an influence on him. And how he was often compared to Marquis de Sade. So, but yeah, he was arrested, and this became pretty much what, and you know, obviously, what defined a lot of the interviews involving him going forward. I think that a lot of people mistakenly thought that, okay, I think that they concluded that he was strictly getting these images for self-pleasure when, as far as I'm concerned, reading sort of in between the lines on his interviews, I do think that there is artistic intent here. I think it's worth noting that he went to art school. He was in a noise band. He was a visual artist. But I think that he intentionally blurs the lines in interviews and intentionally muddies the waters. It's something I've gathered from various interviews in which he contradicts himself, or he goes on these like long rants of non-answers. It reminds me to a degree of David Lynch, how he refuses to discuss his movies.
Interesting. Did you see some of that in the Pompidou Center talk in 2012? Did you happen to see that?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't even think that's probably his most honest interview. The one that he even expressed regret doing interviews on the book. He did an interview for a small podcast on the book Pure Filth. Now, this book chronicles various scenes from pornographer Jamie Gillis. Now, Jamie Gillis was a gonzo pornographer. So in this interview, he kind of talks about how he intentionally kind of like held back. He didn't really put a lot of what would be classical journalism or any perspective or insight in the book. Most of the book is just transcriptions of, you know, gonzo porno scenes. And he talks about this sort of inherent voyeurism he had for these scenes, but that he didn't want to actually see what was happening on the screen. So he put that idea to a book in which it's just the details and just the words that are happening in the scenes without actually having to see the visuals. And the interview in general is very revealing. It kind of touches on some of like the voyeuristic impulses he has. And there's another interview he did where he talked about in his free time, he would put together scenes of, it would be, this is rough to talk about, but it would be, you know, porn scenes from the, you know, some old gonzo filmmaker where men would be coerced into masturbation And then the next scene would be behind the scene footage of journalists coercing victims of crimes into doing interviews. And they would be played back to back. And the thing is, the commentary there is it's kind of obvious. But if you read any interviews with him, he kind of denies any commentary, which I kind of deny his denial is the way I would put it. I think that he intentionally muddies these waters to get people more and more heated and arguing about his work. He kind of tries to shuck it. You know, he doesn't want the responsibility of the commentary.
That's a stark contrast. I wasn't familiar with that one, but it makes a lot of sense for Peter Sotos to design something in that way, because that seems to be, at least in how it relates to true crime, that seems to be his mission statement, is that the underlying truth of what draws us to a lot of these stories is like a primal Schadenfreude, rather than so much of a compassion or empathy, which is something that I think is a really important thing to at least be aware of. I think that the true crime world as a whole can be a little bit too naive, or not even naive sometimes, but overtly delusional about our role in these cases, maybe, and our ethics around it. And it's like, well, if I'm covering something, I'm bringing awareness to it. So I'm doing a good thing. And is that really true? You know, I really appreciate art like this that makes you take a step back and think about your role as a viewer, as an audience, and as a creator. And it kind of made me do all three. And that's something I've always been, you know, in making my podcast, it's something I've always been try to be conscious of, like, how am I creating? Is it in a way that is glorifying violence, or like, what is my motive? I like what you said, which is that truth seems to be a big importance to you in creating Obscura. Could you talk about that and how that relates to Peter Sotos?
Yeah. So, you know, for anyone that's uninitiated and hasn't listened to some of the Peter Sotos CDs out there, there's one, for example, one of the more infamous ones. It's called Buyer's Market. And it's a mixture of a lot of things. And some of them are victims talking about their experiences. Some of them are news interviews, right? And I think this part was intentional, where it's just clips from various news interviews with witnesses that saw crimes or really horrible, awful things that happened. And what's interesting about that CD is that all of these slices of audio are from publicly available sources, right? I think that this in some ways is maybe the album that influenced me the most, right? Because the only thing that's missing is the context. And I think because of that lacking context, people are revolted by the audio. But when you really think about it, that audio already existed. You know, it was already put out there to turn a profit and make money. All he did was slice it and rearrange it and make sort of, you know, the mixtape from hell. But the thing is the key word there was context. And it really does make me think, like, when I'm browsing Twitter and I'll come across a video in my feed and it'll just be people fighting, right? And then you look up and there's that little text there and it says, oh, this person, I don't know, talk trash on his sister or something. You know, and it's always like the winner, right? Like, so like the winner is validated in fighting this person, right? But without that text, it would just be pointless violence in people's minds, right? But the thing is you start to question, even with that context, I mean, it's still violence. You know, these very large Twitter accounts are still making, you know, passive income from this violence. And a lot of times, like, I've looked into it, several of these accounts are just lying. They put fake context, you know, on the Twitter feed. And so I think that's sort of what separates, like, what people view as true crime that's okay and true crime that's not okay. And it's interesting timing, too, because there was a big controversy. A true crime creator, I'm not going to name her, but she was offering just, from what I understand, the case file that included autopsy photos of a child for sale on her Patreon. And it was really, like, without any sort of artistic hand. You know, there wasn't really any context to it. There really wasn't any sort of, there was no angle, right? And so it caused quite the uproar. And, you know, we all kind of create these sort of limits and rules, and she sort of violated it in this case. But it is interesting to contemplate, like, that's that thin line between what's okay and what's not.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. There was, as Justin said, I believe it was two. One was a large creator, one was a smaller creator, and mostly on YouTube, but I think they also had kind of true crime podcasts as well, or maybe their YouTube was just kind of like a true crime podcast. I listened to the one larger creator's apology, and it's funny how we're talking about context. It sounds like there was some missing context. It sounded like it was a case that she had covered on YouTube, and she didn't want to put anything that the family could come across, you know, accidentally on YouTube. So she wanted to cover the entire case file on Patreon in more detail. I believe it was a live stream, like through Patreon, if you can do that. Maybe it was just a video. And within the case file, when they were reviewing it, was autopsy photos. And she said also that there were no nude pictures, which was one of the big details, was like nude autopsy photo. But it kind of felt like, and I might be off base here, but my reaction in all this is that true crime has unethical creators who just seem to want to come in, cash in off of people's tragedies. And we all have this self, probably morally righteous reaction that's not necessarily a bad thing towards those kinds of people. And I think this was a little bit of a scapegoat or a whipping boy type situation where this person was a very convenient outlet for that righteous anger. And she did cross the line. I think so. Like, I think showing autopsy photos and selling it on Patreon, no matter if that's how you're marketing it, it's a little bit of a gray area. But it seems like a little bit of an overreaction, like people calling for her Patreon to be deleted, which I think it already was. People want her entire YouTube channel deleted. You know, I'm not sure. I think that might be a little bit of a energy in the wrong place in my mind.
Yeah, I'll be honest. One of the reasons why I didn't mention their name is because I'm not fully familiar with the situation, so I haven't really provided much comment on it publicly or anything. I do think it was interesting timing considering this discussion. And I guess, you know, whether she provided the context or not, I guess what mattered in the end is that the general public didn't get that context, right? And it sort of falls under the umbrella of what we're talking about here with Peter Sotos. Because the sort of thing that is carried throughout his work is there's this really disturbing sense of voyeurism. And what will happen, though, if you take the time, and it's very difficult, but if you take the time to read through some of the work, it gets you to start asking questions about yourself and why you indulge in some of the things that you do and some of the media and some of the videos that you do. And it starts to make you ask yourself if you're sort of engaging in this, you know, this game of like, oh, well, yeah, you know, what I'm doing is right. And what I'm doing is, you know, okay. And it's great because I'm providing this context and this empathy, you know, when at the end of the day, you really should be questioning, what comes next, the aftermath, right? Like I've personally, made it a point to cover as little as possible in the way of, mass shooters. I did touch on a certain mass shooter where I didn't even list their name in an episode, but it had more to do with the sort of, 4chan rabbit hole that a lot of these mass shooters have fallen down. And so it was more so about that than the shooting itself. But it's been repeatedly talked about that one of the things that creates mass shootings is the media coverage. But we've done nothing to change that. And there hasn't been an outcry for it to stop.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think I have seen a little bit of like a push. Maybe it doesn't happen in the big cases, but I feel like I have seen less naming of mass shooters. Maybe that's wrong though. Yeah, I do think that would be a good thing. You know, it reminds me of, this is a really kind of silly analogy, but I watch baseball a lot, and there's a thing where a fan will run on the field and the TV cameras used to zoom in on the spectacle. But they realized that it just encouraged more people. So now, as soon as somebody runs on the field, they don't show them, like a streaker, or pretty much in any sport, the cameras will not broadcast it.
And yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not even particularly, you know, grandstanding for a cause or anything. It's just sort of like the stands that I take when I create my own content. You know, I kind of stay in my own lane for the most part. I tend not to like really lash out against others for the content they create. And one of the things I'll say too is like, sometimes I'll be in the supermarket and there'll be a People magazine or something. And you'll see in big bold letters, like little girl's family dead. She's without loved ones and, you know, things like that right on the front cover. And I'm like, it's kind of interesting to think that people accept that as fine, but like, I wouldn't even, you know, I would be aghast at wording it that way in my own show, you know? And, I guess my point, as far as that relates to the current thing we're talking about with like YouTube creators and podcast creators, is that, I do feel like sometimes they're under the eye of scrutiny, stronger than even the mainstream media.
Yeah. I think that can be the case. Yeah, that's right. Because it's like, okay, that magazine probably sold a few million copies. Meanwhile, this YouTube creator's getting a few thousand views, probably in comparison. Yeah, it's interesting. I think maybe it's more of because that's our world. So when it hits that close to home, it's like, whoa, you know, people feel a need to speak on it. But yeah, I think far too much. It's kind of disappointing to me, to be honest, as true crime creators will, at least in this case, I mean, it was kind of disappointing how quickly people spoke without seeming to have looked at the full story. And again, I agree with you. I'm not telling anybody how they should feel or shouldn't feel. But after reading more into it, the line between this was a morally good thing to do or a morally bad thing, that line seemed a lot more gray than, oh, this was somebody, you know, they had a collection of 10 nude images of a child and they were selling them on Patreon. You know, it's like, that's kind of what the story was, but the reality wasn't really that.
You'll see this kind of stuff, like the public in general, they'll kind of distort these kind of discussions in a self-serving way. A more recent example is, I believe her name was Carly Russell. She went missing on the freeway recently.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, I was following the discussion for that very closely. It was it was something that interested me a great deal. And what's interesting is that everyone was sure beforehand that it was a human trafficking incident and that she had been baited out. And we don't have the full details yet, but they were so sure. And I remember even thinking to myself, like, oh man, cases like this, you know, they don't end well. And, you know, the likelihood of her returning is very small. And then, you know, the following day she's back home and we don't know the full story yet, but going back online, you know, there's been a little bit of a secrecy, you know, surrounding the case. The police are still working it and they don't want to let all the details out. It's interesting seeing the comments from people that seem to feel that they have a right to know currently. Yeah, there's a lot of anger and there's a lot of assumptions being made. And, you know, maybe there's something going on here that will be cast. We'll cast her in a negative light. But I've always been one to try to reserve my judgment until the details come out. And I think, you know, that the sort of knee jerk reaction that we're seeing with that kind of echoes the knee jerk reaction for that content creator. People kind of instantly make their minds up before they've actually, you know, done any digging or have the full details.
I want to talk a little bit about and get some of your, I mean, we've kind of reviewed it a little bit, but the artistic merit of, I guess what's hard for me kind of pivoting back to Peter Sotos is how extreme it is. It seems like to me, there's a lot of these points that could be achieved through other means or through a different approach. And maybe that's not fair. Maybe it's not fair to like look at an artist and criticize how they choose to approach something to make a point. But I kind of want to maybe get into like some of the worst Peter Sotos stuff. And you know how we talked about how we can agree with artists, but maybe not everything they do. And I think we all do this, right? With Hollywood and movies we watch, the directors we watch, the actors we watch. There's one scene that has really stuck with me. It's in Pure issue number 2 by Peter Sotos. And there is a very vivid description of child rape. And there's a picture of 8 children. They're missing photos. They're ages 5 to 13. And I'm not sure whose penis this is, but there's a fully erect penis ejaculating, almost kind of like the collage is made. So the ejaculate is like on the children's faces. And this image is so shocking and inappropriate, especially when right next to the description of rape. And the description of rape is so vivid. It's unlike any other, you know, you read rape in a Stephen King book or in a fiction book or even in a real book. It's nothing like this. This is the most brutal description. And I'm wondering, I mean, I can see like some of the artistic arguments here, like we've been talking about media and that. Do you think this is one of the cases of where the line is pushed, or how do you like process this kind of part of Peter Sotos's work?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like my brain is working in two different directions. And on one hand, I absolutely do think it crosses a line. And like, I'll just say that I personally wouldn't sign off on this. I don't necessarily agree with it. But at the same time, as someone that just, you know, their brain starts working when they see art presented in front of them, and as disturbing as it is, you know, you have to ask yourself, is this a commentary, you know, on sort of the pornographic element of true crime, that, you know, people you know, getting off isn't maybe the right term, but, you know, are they getting pleasure from reading Helter Skelter or In Cold Blood or A Stranger Beside Me, or, you know, whatever, Anne Rule books or Obscura when they listen to Obscura, right? You know, is that commentary, you know? I kind of think it is. I think he downplays it on purpose to cause it to be more confrontational and confusing and get people angry. I think it's intentional. But yeah, no, I do think it's very confronting seeing that. You know, it's upsetting. It's disturbing. I couldn't imagine being in the mindset to make that. But at the same time, what's worse, right? I covered, it's going to be more episodes, but so far there's two episodes I've covered on sort of sexual abusers in the world of science fiction, right? There's a lot of science fiction writers, like a shocking number of them that have been involved in this. And not only have they not been called out, there are some of them still working today. And there's one in particular who has students that he hands pro-pedophilia literature out to. And so, like, what's worse? Is it worse to see the confrontational sort of, like, in-your-face, you know, like, haunting imagery like that? Or is it worse to have sort of seductive language hidden in mainstream science fiction novels to sort of seduce readers' minds into thinking certain things are okay, right? Is the sort of overt extremeness of Peter Sotos worse than the subtle, subversive, pro-pedophilia literature that's hidden in mainstream writing?
Yeah, I'm thinking of like Lolita, what's the other one? Leon the Professional.
Leon the Professional.
I mean, it's a great film. So is Lolita. I mean, both versions, or probably there's three of them now, but it's pretty inarguably trying to normalize, or at least it presents it in a kind of romantic, seductive way, a relationship with a child.
Yeah, and there's even recent stuff. Vanilla Ice once released a track called Having a Roni that was about sleeping with underage fans backstage. You know, this stuff is like surprising. The BBC, they covered for a lot of sexual abuse. And when pressured on it, they just completely, you know, noped out of the discussion, said, you know, we're not going to talk about it. Jimmy Savile being one of them, but he's just part of the iceberg. There was a lot more going on there. And these guys were in plain sight. And you have to wonder, like, what they were kind of subversively laying down and, you know, their entertainment. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of tough. Like, it's hard to decry something that puts me off. Like, I can't even, when I read like Sotos, I can't even finish paragraphs, you know, like I have to look away. And I almost find it worse having this stuff hidden in there, I guess is the way I would put it.
Yeah, I think too, there's an honesty in it that, like, okay, I think here's how I would take Peter Sotos. And again, I'm kind of like, this is the non-expert opinion who hasn't really studied enough of his work to really have a firm opinion. But so far, it feels like I think it would be a mistake to laud Peter Sotos as some kind of visionary genius for this work. I don't know. I could be wrong about that. But on the flip side, I also think it would be way too convenient, and it would be not really productive to write off his work as merely the writings of insane pedophile, which you might do upon first glance. But I do think that would be wrong, because I think there is a larger there is a larger picture here and a larger statement. But I would say the one thing that I really wouldn't have thought of before I started covering true crime is, and it kind of relates back to the YouTube thing around a child's autopsy photo being put on Patreon is the victim's families, like putting a focus on that more, which I think in all of true crime reform, or so to speak, reform or ethics, I think that's one area that there's really nothing bad that can come from trying to focus more on victims' families. And, you know, just like putting a missing child's face next to a ejaculating penis, like, poof, like it's just like, if I were a parent and happened across that of my own child, like it would be, not to say, but that's the other thing too. If you kind of have to seek Peter Sotos out, and you don't have to seek out the picture in the grocery store with the crying kid, like you were saying, that's almost, it's subversive, but it's almost more offensive because it's selling a lie. Like, you're doing something good by reading about the pain of this family, you know? And it's like, well, how, why, you know, anytime I try to see this again, this is the conundrum of Peter Sotos, is anytime I try to make a statement about him, I find myself still unsure about how I actually feel about his work.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, you know, for people listening to this discussion is that, you kind of said it at the start, like I would certainly not go out of my way to say that Peter Sotos is some visionary genius or anything like that. If anything, I would say that, I benefited from his art more so than the man himself, because I'll never know his full intentions. You know, I'll never know why he's making what he's making. I'm certainly not signing off on a lot of his choices. And in fact, I actually disagree with a lot of his choices. Like you said, like, you know, if it was my kid and he was putting those images next to it, I would feel a certain way about that. Right. But I would say that it was formative for me to come across the most extreme version of the content that I create, like to sort of see the outer limits, the sort of, because I don't think, you know, it would be very hard to sort of reach that level that he has reached sort of passively, I guess, like that was just in him, because it's not in me. But what I will say, though, is there are some true crime creators, and I'm not going to name names, right, that do a lot of, you know, deep web exploring, and some of the details that they have placed in their script, you know, they didn't pull these out of thin air. You know what I mean? They were viewing certain materials, and it's not unlike what Peter Sotos was doing when he was arrested. And I would assume it's pretty similar, you know, actually. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing. And, you know, when I talk about that one case I won't cover, there are a few episodes out there that are very descriptive, you know, I'll put it that way. And I would say that that's, you know, that's sort of that Peter Sotos, like bottom of the well, darkest part of the cave type of true crime.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. I'm reminded of the Nietzsche quote about if you gaze into the abyss, the abyss gazes also into you. It's a dangerous game, even with reading Peter Sotos stuff. I felt an internal way that I have rarely felt even by reading about true crime cases. I do agree that Peter Scully case, the one you you're referring to, there are certain ones that make me feel that kind of way. And yeah, I mean, there are some true crime creators that go out and cover those cases in extreme detail. And they probably aren't listening to this, but anybody who does, I mean, I'm sure there are people who listen to your podcast that want a podcast one day. I mean, I know there's a couple of my fans that do want to do true crime podcasting. And I would just say, you know, yeah, just be cautious covering those cases, because it's like you said that you almost felt like you got PTSD from covering, I forget her name, the one that we put on the True Crime Pod Presents. Yeah,
Kaylin Nicole Davis.
Yeah. And these more extreme, I almost wonder if that's what might have happened a little bit to Peter Sotos, is unless he is a straight up psychopath, which I don't think so. I can't imagine like dedicating that much time and effort into a project that's so focused on the bottom of the well content. I'm concerned for his soul and anybody's soul who is that focused on that much darkness, or that extremity of darkness, I guess.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I've scraped my toe at the bottom a little bit a couple times. There's that Black Label episode 2 on the porn industry, and you know, the one I did on the Animal Crush industry as well. You know, I would say that's about the closest I've gotten to that sort of like Sotos level material. And even after I released those episodes, I was like, man, I need to do some reflecting, you know, like, and that's the thing, is that I think as well, finding Sotos, you know, work, I even like hesitate to fully call it art sometimes because it's so voyeuristic. It also taught me my limits. You know, and when I started creating true crime, I always wanted to inject, you know, a sense of empathy. But then, you know, Sotos fans, you know, he does have fans out there. They would call that empathy self-serving. You know, that's their argument. But that is self-serving empathy and nothing more. Right. So it's a constant conflict. And I think any discussion involving Peter Sotos that's in good faith, you know, not just like knee jerk, is going to involve a lot of confusion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I'm always fascinated in the empathy discussion because I get that. I think especially in creating, there is a big trap of deluding yourself into that you're doing more good than you really are. It's like that kind of thing where it's much easier to see it in someone else than it is in yourself. But once you see it, you become more aware of it. But I wonder, do you think empathy has an intrinsic goodness or like benefit for society? You know, even if you are, say, indulging in empathy, just to, as Peter Sotos might visualize it, jack off, you know, is there something, you know, is jacking yourself off with empathy, is there something intrinsically maybe superior versus jacking yourself off with, I'm using the most, you know, lowbrow verbiage here, but jacking yourself off to, sadomasochistic or sadist feelings. Do you think there's a difference there? Or do you think that's basically all the same thing?
Well, I think sometimes it can be a misstep. One of the reasons why Sotos created published the Jamie Gillis book in the first place is that Paul Thomas Anderson had made Boogie Nights, which was sort of the romanticized version of what Jamie Gillis was. And so the Pure Filth book that he made on Jamie Gillis wasn't, you know, an attempt to sort of set things straight, right? And it's just a voyeuristic book that doesn't really have anything to say and just shows things as they were. And so there is an argument to be made at times that, you know, it's a tough thing to juggle because, for example, the Jeffrey Dahmer TV show that came out, they actually cut things out from his childhood and even sort of changed some of the facts. in school, he could actually be quite popular at times. He was considered a bit of a class clown and a stoner. There were pictures of him like acting like a goofball and stuff. And I think in the show, they sort of played up the idea that kids sensed that he was a monster from like an early age. And, you know, maybe that's for the better, though, because to the public, it makes him less cool. But then you have that debate. Well, yeah, that's nice and all, but it's not the truth. It's not the reality of what actually happened. So, yeah, I don't know. I have like an internal struggle sometimes on whether detachment is sort of the right way to cover true crime or injecting that layer of empathy into the way that you cover it. It's a tough philosophical debate.
It's almost like Peter Soto sees true crime, the true crime world, and maybe just media in general, as taking this shortcut to the Disney fairy tale Hollywood ending where everybody's united and you feel empathy and, you know, all the good things. And he sees that as a betrayal of truth. And so instead of using the truth to kind of achieve a similar end, he uses the truth in just the most raw, brutal way to just bash you over the head and say, no, you idiot, that's not real. And he has such a seeming, and maybe that's what's so disturbing, is the complete lack of regard for the end goal. Will this corrupt somebody's soul? Will it make them a better person? I don't care. Here's the truth of the brutality of these crimes. And if you want to see the truth, this is what it is. So in that sense, I can respect that, even though it's repulsive and it's grotesque. It's truth. It is, you know, child molestation and child rape. There's nothing glamorous, or I mean, it can make you feel empathy in the same way that watching somebody get their head chopped off can make you feel empathy. It's brutal, it's grotesque, it's horrific. And yeah, Peter Soto's just bashes you in the head with it with no regard for your well-being or his well-being or society's well-being.
I do think that there is something to that, you know. I do think that it's one of those things that I do have a begrudging respect for. You know, I experienced child sexual abuse when I was a kid. And his work is like the only thing I can think of that can, you know, really catalogs that like horrific experience in a light that like really exposes how terrible it is. And like, you know, like I said before, no one can really fully know Peter Sotos' intentions, right? But the thing is, you know, if you ever heard of the term, you know, death of the author, this work, it doesn't exist in a vacuum of just Peter Sotos' brain. The reader is going to extract meaning from it. And, you know, I almost think it's impossible not to. And so, depending on what you extract, you're going to have a certain reaction to it. And let me tell you, if you Google his work and you go to places like Reddit or other forums, the opinions are all over the place. And so if Peter Sotos's, if his desire was to intentionally muddy the water and intentionally be as vague and cause confusion with his work and as much of that as possible, then, you know, he was successful.
There's a quote that relates back to that a little bit, but it's one that stuck with me from his Pompidou Center talk, which anybody, if you've listened to this, you probably have some interest, and it would probably be unrealistic to expect you not to start Googling Peter Sotos and trying to find some of his work. But maybe before you do, I think his Pompidou Center talk is at least maybe a little taste of just his personality before, you know. And I honestly, yeah, I would strongly caution if you haven't listened to Justin's Obscura a Baki or a Crush, listen to those first. And if you can't get through those, don't read Peter Sotos, because it's that type of extremity. There's this quote, "I don't think art is a conversation between the reader and the creator. It's an intensely selfish and personal internal dialogue, just exactly like experience." I think I sent you that quote, Justin, too. And it's something first I want to ask you if you think that's Peter Sotos just putting us on, kind of like sending us down the wrong rabbit hole. Like you said, he can mislead us. Or if just your take on that, because it's something that I've been kind of reflecting on in my own journey as true crime.
I like that quote quite a lot, because I don't think he ever had any idea that his work was going to like take off. I do think that whatever you feel about it, it's definitely personal. He's not he didn't make this to make it in Hollywood or something. You know, you're not going to turn heads in a positive way making this kind of stuff. So I do think it is deeply personal. And I think that in some ways, a lot of true crime creators, it's the same way. You know, like a lot of us have no aspirations to do anything else. You know, like for me personally, like I'm here to create my show and I'm happy doing that. And that's what I'm here to do. And so every little small decision I make is a personal one. So, yeah, no, I definitely see wisdom in that.
When I was just started out with my podcast, I had a friend who was also doing a true crime podcast, and actually was a little more popular than mine. But he wanted to get into fiction podcasting, and this true crime, he saw it as kind of like an entryway to kind of build an audience and then get into the fiction thing. And he was kind of always kind of asking me if I wanted to join him in the fiction thing. And while I enjoy writing some fiction, I was always confused, because it was like true crime was the end goal for me. Like, this is what I feel like I need to be doing. You know, when people talk about like a calling or something like that, I don't know that might sound a little bit narcissistic, but it's like, I feel at home telling these stories, you know, reflecting on my own ethical decisions. And yeah, it's just something that I really, really enjoy doing. But I would say the one caveat I would put on there is that, you know, Peter Sotos says art is not a conversation, or at least that's the way he views it. And I view it so much as a conversation up until this point. That's why this quote hit me so hard, is although those decisions are very personal, like you're saying, when you're making decisions and editing and recording and writing, each one of those decisions I make, I'm almost always thinking of who's listening and how they're going to process it. And maybe that's a little bit of shackling, or like self imprisonment. Do you think that, you know, having the, you know, everybody always says write with your audience in mind, but do you think that that can be a trap? Do you think we should be writing more in the true crime world as if it's not a conversation?
Well, I mean, I think it just really depends on your goals, right? I'm creating content that I want to share with others, and the conversation that comes from that is part of what I enjoy. The difference is that, you know, Peter Sotos is creating art as voyeurism. And I think, you know, the nature of that beast is that it's a self-seclusionary. He's intentionally writing as objectively from his own personal experience and views as he can. And I think that when you do that, right, put it this way, you and I, having had this conversation and probably other things we've spoken with our audiences about, they can understand where we're coming from. We have excluded ourselves from being able to create the type of work Peter Sotos creates by the nature of our actions. There would be no confusion to the work that we create because we've been open and we've opened that sort of bridge of dialogue with our audiences. By, you know, Peter Soto's lighting that bridge on fire and covering it with broken glass, he can create the experience that he does with his art. It's that sort of cutting the audience off from what he's actually feeling or thinking and muddying the waters that allows him to kind of shock you and question you know what you're reading every sentence. You know, every single sentence, you're jumping back and forth. Like, is this a social commentary or is this a disturbed man?
Did you have, I kind of covered it. There were a few other things that I was thinking about going into, but I feel like we've covered so much of everything I wanted to say. Is there any aspect of Peter Sotos that you wanted to talk more about?
No, because I think after a while, you can essentially find yourself talking in circles when it comes to his work, because it's like at the end of American Psycho, the book and the movie, there's a sign on the wall that says no exit, which is like the way of telling the reader or viewer, this is not an ending. You know what I mean? Like, this doesn't end here. You're just, you know, excluded now. You don't get to know what happens next. I feel like by its very nature, the Peter Sotos discussion is always going to just be, you know, a dog chasing its tail.
Yeah, I agree with you. The more you talk about Peter Sotos, the kind of, you know, without just reading his book aloud, you kind of, yeah, there's only so much you can say before you're just saying the same shit over and over. So yeah, I will read this warning from the interview with Peter Sotos. It says, warning, if reading about blatant misogyny, undistilled sadism, fervent victimization, or the abuse of children offends you, do not read Peter Sotos. It's the most extreme true crime, but I think it's deserving of a discussion. It's a deserving topic of reflection.
Yeah, I appreciate the talk. This is something that I've thought about talking about on Fireside Chat for a little while now, but it's like one of those things that without someone to sort of ping your ideas off of, it's a hard thing to talk about because you almost want to be challenged when talking about this type of subject. You don't want to be left to your own devices because, you know, it's like navigating through a minefield. And I have no idea how anyone's going to take this discussion in general. But just know, like, hey, we did our best here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're just giving our raw thoughts and you're totally free to disagree with us. Like if someone found, you know, listened to this and found a issue of Pure or one of his works and read two sentences and thought we were both fucking crazy because it's just degenerate, absolute filth, then I would not disagree with you. I would say
yeah, you're fair.
That is a valid argument. Honestly, I wouldn't. I wouldn't criticize that. I would say I would think you're wrong, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't argue with you. I would totally respect that opinion.
I really don't want anyone here who's didn't know what they were coming for, yeah? First of all, I suck at this. I get obviously fairly nervous. And secondly, I don't think you need to see this. If you don't have an interest in the subject, it gets contentious. And on one hand, I worry about sounding dangerous, you know, like I'm full of myself. And on the other hand, I just worry about pissing off people who don't need to fucking be here. So it's so bad, you know, my own neuroses, that I want to thank some people here, but I don't know whether to do it because people complain, and I sound full of myself, like I'm a fucking egoist. But then they get in trouble too. I've had like, I don't know, so many fucking books pulled. You can't sell fewer copies than me. And yet they still get in trouble. So just please, you know, don't, if you don't, do you guys know what the fuck I do? You know? It's just, I'm not here to be provocative. And I really do want to say thank you to the Pompidou, first of all, for like putting up with this shit. And also Dennis Cooper for, you know, see, I feel like I'm blaming him. I really appreciate his interest and his kindness. And Pierre Dort is the reason I'm here. He asked, and so, sorry. Je suis désolé. Okay. So I'm going to show these slides of my archives that are just basically newspaper clippings that I've put over things, and I'm going to try and read this as quickly as I can. And you have little prayer books there, so follow along. A finer definition of pornography is an act, an applicable idea that exists between identification and indulgence. As a conversation, it's an apology. More literally, it's a building. Men alone in appealing groups don't make themselves less lonely. Mid-level desperation doesn't last long enough. Like aesthetics and the news, pornography requires smaller personal definition. It's too serious, too perpetual, to be reduced to relief, joy, torment, nature. Divestiture merely slows the quick subjective monologue working hardest to destroy objective worry. According to Genet and Sartre and Genet, I'm from Chicago, and Sartre and Genet via Lang, there's two fantasies at work while one masturbates. The jagoff becomes the viewer and the subject all at once, all at one time. Hope that uncontrollable thoughts can crash and attack, and the choral reality that as many names as I can burn into a single focus chosen beforehand can be imprecised again. Conceptually, empathy is located to be exploded personally. Respect and compromise skinned forward a priori. Decisions are cheap, tolerance is sexually dismissed or sexually stupidly snide. As such, I wouldn't think that the slides I'm showing at this side and speed are secondary to my rambling. And I realize my questionably private tautology belies any explanation as transparent, judicious fumble. The employable definition of dignity, as allowed by internecine autonomies, never extends quite past defensive ploy. Stalled consistently all over, only ever cute vulnerables. Voila. I do this is still more important than anything else, far less personally contentious or edifying. It'd only be rehab to say that the subject chose me. My interest in these newspaper clippings and media reports inspired less and less interest in journalistic detail research and more repulsive fascination with reductive imagery and cruder imaginary specifics, which is how intensely necessary it was to the men like me that crowded over the floors of adult bookstores. I do want to extend it, fully understand, and enjoy the hardly blank stare one pretends or hopes to have. This is proof on one side, evidence on the other, overworried on each. Move an interest to a taste to a history. You don't lose yourself in fantasy, you don't lose yourself at all. Your baby isn't here anymore, you should talk about it, poor dear. I tell myself telling you. The space between my description and the potential audience is where I've lived my entire life. The audience I've created for myself is antagonistic. This isn't without reason. It may well be paranoid, not just self-important. In fact, I'm absolutely aware of and profoundly bothered by the centrality of the personalized language, a mild form of autism where I might needlessly write down circumspect details and motives until the obsession alone creates experience. In the space between what I do write and the warnings that suggest you're not especially interested, is a space between how and why I seek to explain myself and repeat. Add to that another space between what is easy and what is worth the effort. Too much work to be impulsive, too much work to say it's only a job, kind of like sex. Yeah. The highly exciting, never fucking ending abyss between obscenity, legal, and purience, personal. Also a sexually slimy history to a rigidly human, still sexual responsibility. Writing is the only form that pulls the space tighter. That's my personal intention. All of this would still be my foraging. Placing news clippings on a wall in a gallery instead of my pocket starts the half-postmodern misunderstanding that artists and the emotionally needful could see it in full as another artist speaking on overwhelming pain, bravely declaring his own guilt and willingness to change, or your duty to see injustice more selfishly. Imagine that the totality of these clippings could drag down the personalized sensibilities of the daily uncaring reader and slogged-up family. The breakdowns at the side, the vulgar disappreciation of wretched gossip wives and armchair vampires, out of context, forgotten, into context, vulgar, and hurtful, unsympathetic, unhelpful, and then wrong and silly, adolescent and introspective. Not one fucking case in there of incest. You look backwards and see that my interest was slightly more degenerate than the new apologies. Currently confused revelations and prospective groundbreaking first responder sympathy. There's more than just the book between me and the reader, just like there's more between me and the book. Writing creates realities. It's like all fucking life up there. So many of the obsessions, tastes, little cocksucking details that I try and make sense of, which to me is essentially what writing is, changes and mutates before it hits paper. Further, I'm aware that my opinions are oftentimes clouded by meager circumstance and various other prejudices, which again is why they're committed to paper. There isn't one universal truth that I'm trying to elucidate. I'm not trying to convince others that I'm right or know how to live or that they're plainly wrong. Though I'm fucking sure of it, frankly. I think there is more to be had, and I hope my work is rigorous enough to nail it in context and taste. I don't think art is a conversation between the reader and the creator. It's an intensely selfish obsession and a personal internal dialogue, just exactly like experience. Art needs to be honest to the artist and judge backward from that point of need. It's exciting to see. I don't excuse idiots just because their art is as honest as their stupidity. Similarly, I don't discount liars as readily as those who might only be looking for honesty. There's only one art, no other life, no less chafed by contradiction. Those who don't do the work, don't pay attention, shouldn't ask grimy questions later. I've always thought that no matter what I write, no matter that it is always about sex, the fact that I was using pinnable names, because there are real names up there, you know, real people, in quotes, because you don't know the people, and then everyone wants to tell you how they suffered alike, that makes the word truly exist. It legitimized the use of the word true, ruined the zeitgeist to qualify acts as mere or positioned, and made the appreciation of most everyone else's work quaint. Very often the facts were wrong, the placement was exactly right, and since I got most of my information far further than secondhand, the facts never fucking mattered to real anything anyway. The little wonders mattered before the news was splashed over them. And I was only ever trying to get them to matter more. A true pedophile, I always thought. I'm sure that I really do love all of them. I want so much for these little poor fucked names all the time. I so desperately want to see these black and white paper reproductions as vividly ripped apart and rat protected as every fucking mouth out there constantly barks back at me. I know why I pick the ones I do. I know who gives them to me. I understand how chaste they are and why. And I wish it worked. And when it does, even more. As a result, I find myself with decades and memories of brief reportage but central artful faces. Danny Bridges, Chicago trash mother, screaming over tears in the alley near the dumpster her hustling boy was discovered dropped. Result being then, I've stopped listening to those who only imagine language needs to be broken apart and played with to delineate the exact same fucking emotions. I know what child pornography is because I know what the appeal is. Hopefully, can separate the offer from the draw. And weigh out the professionals and phonies who rescript words to compassion and their more immediate sense of what a tool you most likely are. I'm not tortured by the thoughts or the common difficulty in expression. I've done best to keep these thoughts as real as words only. The The first mistake, thinking words need a physical component. The second mistake, assuming that anything not physical, not pragmatic, is spiritual, ineffable, or metaphysical. In this way, what I do, everything, can seem less than and guarded. All of this doesn't require such a small amount of understanding from the observer to have to penetrate it physically. Language is smashed to its inadequacies and inequities in courts and legal tests. Not in clever, creative, imperfect sales, there's another space, this one being the two-tiered psychological definition of treatable pedophilia, being any poor deer who suffers from persistent and recurrent thoughts concerning the sexual desire towards children. The worth of the condition lies directly between nag and experience, as if one experiences what one desires, raped children to a wet, stupid kiss that lasts forever. Anything else that happens after the thought, psychologically speaking, is suffering from something other than pedophilia. Sociopathy, malignant narcissism, convenient lucky fucking trauma. I need to explain myself, and I swear I already have. And these explanations don't sound desperate enough, or too obvious, too thin. I can tell you why it's children in these clippings. And my imaginary therapist cum foil will tell me what a little nature in you means a little charm and patience and satisfaction given luckily forward as an eventually extinguished promise. That sex is more natural than violence, and we need to split the two into legal and troll, monster and owner, fiend and griever. My doctors allow for a right to sex and its desire and insist their condescension isn't as insulting as their promise is. I can make myself miss them too. I can't fucking wait to get rid of it, as you do with pornography, which is not an analogy. This shit that gets called my archives has never been precious, which, as an insult towards and a definition of the people that are named and cheaply, quickly described in astounding numbers but not types within, seems essential to what I'm missing in the now obligatory social sense. Every clipping has a name. Parables won't work. I've represented them here and before with aggression, with insult, carried from one booth to another like a scrounging anything cocksucker. The pretense is context that can't reflect purity, but purity is impossible, not even chimerous. I know this from artists, not floor wipers and wife hiders, cheap strung-out youth and old fat lonelies. Exciting, exoriating, and expansive, but not illuminating. It is pejorative when realized as next best. Lionel Manns, Antoine Dagata, Andrea Dworkin, Lou Reed, Dennis. Don't require me to finish their work for them. I'm not bringing my own tired filth to their work and can't find quite the necessary dearth that I do there and here, where I spend the entirety of my time hallucinating, if lucky. Still, I can't brag healthfully that I haven't kept them, but I have made them into something else, something I probably shouldn't have, something that I shouldn't have had to. I've separated the voices from the faces, I've compared the cases, the motives keep becoming mine rather than theirs. I've placed them end to end and re-released them, paginated and compiled, and even better, not drawn out the quiet themes that centralize the sexless nature of the words when drawled with pity and concern. I've seen what I can say about their worth and mimic the part where they become real and overwhelming, but it is more important to me and easy, frankly, not to let that happen after it doesn't. I'm not presenting a collage, contentious or surprising. I don't care if you miss something small. The aesthetics come now from time and persistence and recurrence, which again is the definition of pedophilia. Intrepid predisposition, another one. This, I hope, is what I am, that none of this has succeeded on its own. I look all around for these photos, other photos that remind me of only more formative, still central, plain fucking photos. These pictures of newsworthy children have almost entirely come from parents and relatives handing them over to cops and press. The headlines alone often work just as well, sadly. Proof is backless. I want a book that belonged to a man that correctly decided that sex is too frightening, too ugly, too cruel, never not revolting, never not good enough, never good enough, and progressively, if allowed to stop anywhere in taste or obsession or sensation, just clinically depressing. He hasn't talked himself out. He is weak, passive, consistently terrified, and because he's been so timidly careful over what little he uses and looks for, sometimes seems to understand that anything else better than this one turgid, emotionally cloying picture is impossible. These images are all about kids attacked by men who couldn't most likely wouldn't control themselves for a few more important moments. Sex is central, not children. Not that I want to deny the focus. I know what shelves and price groupings to avoid by now. Booths with signs that limit entry by age and gender, and if you're lucky, price and experience, like Rue Saint-Denis. Created for this absolutely base understanding of the briefest, pure, and subtle. I've taken, for more than an expository or dialectic example, these clippings, and stuck these photos of smiles, not pictures of smiles being raped necessarily, into adult sexual situations, where children and even thoughts about children are not allowed. For whatever sickness, I thought my kids belonged there. But it's my name on the axe, my mistakes, my joy in what is found directly focused and wanting and miserable on what little I know has happened. The ones that aren't sanctioned apart and officially proscribed. The ones that the runts above me allow and shrug their shoulders piteously, if not derogatively, are the same fucking phonies that own a despicable luck. And yet I agree that it's a mistake. Every single clipping does this to their unreal, tiresome, safest best. They, which they are not, do not exist without me. I'd prefer to answer that this is what happens while I masturbate, you know, in public. That all of this has been created secondhand to what I only wanted to watch for 5 minutes of yanking. A moment where I recognize myself as if that recognition was the tertiary plus. Pictures of children being barely forced to lay compliant, needy man of enough age difference to suggest better intentions than irresponsible, primitive disarticulation. Run through a sedentary brain that stares at pretty, pasty children stripped of fucking knot and worthless sexual loss. Ideally, I'd like the child's words. This is impossible. The child has nothing. No words, no stories, no result, no fantasy blurred life to excuse yet. I tend to pick the younger ones. It's a homosexual work. Every single clipping and photo background is my bore into old men masturbating onto themselves, loosing themselves onto others. Add them all up, and I haven't picked one sensible argument in favor of sexual expression or unique sexual constitutions because I have yet to see one. These were compiled from print periods that kept to a pretense of news over self-celebrity opinion. The information was harder to get, and the facts less amplified and ambitious, though never more reliable. As my years went on and my focus never switched, I tended to put the specious and worthlessly verifiable facts to the side with little worry or consequence. I'd prefer, perhaps, that the context isn't mine. I prefer to imagine, to keep the context theirs. I'd like to keep this away from having it stapled onto a wall and have it considered as my comment on how the news has changed and damaged, somehow explicably, the precise thoughts that are meant to be disseminated through these collected, clipped, hardly precious prizes. Maybe there's something better to do. They are current, still constant. It is, in fact, impossible for me to argue otherwise. Bruised slightly by abject confession, less responsible than reductive, I can't think of a single good reason to feel noble, like when you're alone, and not wasting precious time by choice, you know, jerking off. I have the fucking library. I tape it off TV, and I scrawl her name on the side and keep it still. I wrote her baby's name, and its mother, father, fucking lawyer, among the more insignificant, have, in fact, complained that my appropriation of its name was wrong and illegal. She's the one I have on the screen. Reduce the interest of pornographic impulse to a fact. Facts that deny release to create a longer collection of decades over memories. First, they shouldn't have had their names in the paper. And every fucking day since. The consistency of her name and his gropes is not highlighted, but completely, perfectly created by a taste for allowances made well over my head. Acoustic separation, negative externality, the laws that seek to conclusively identify the principle of harm and the sovereignty of dignity. Economic and legislative concepts created the shorthand obscenity to moral autonomy. I do actually think these pictures should be here, not in some art museum that has the bad taste to pander to a generally lazy or pleasant public, play out one by one after all and then again while I talk about what I've done ever since my arrest. And more importantly, since the very first time I saw what either I wanted to see or didn't fucking know how really terrible it was, but at least you know you have some proof in legalese because there's court records. In fact, that not only did I see it, but that I went looking for it, no matter what I say. I won't accept that the search took over as the obsession, the same way as I don't see the wider work they've done as merely wanting to while away every night away from their noisy daughters and wives. This is better and closer to what they get or what they say they want instead. Voila. So, you know, if you're not bored enough, excited enough, I'm going to show this film, yeah? And the film is just some kind poor person. The film is really just TV edits from TV, yeah? But it sort of moves, and I tried to take the children's voices away from them. So there's a tendency to see it as sort of American vulgarity. God knows why you'd get that idea. But it's less a comment on the news and more a comment on the thoughts that sort of go on and on and on. So merci beaucoup. I'm going to go have a cigarette.
Stop. Before you consider taking drastic measures to lose weight, like GLP-1 injections, consider Golo. Golo's release is easier than injections and fad diets. No need to jump through insurance hoops. It's simple. You take one release supplement with each meal. Golo's release supplement contains 7 natural plants and 3 key minerals that target body fat and combat the stress of dieting. With Golo, you follow the Golo for Life plan, where you'll safely and effectively control sugar cravings and hunger while minimizing muscle loss, allowing you to feel good and inspired to reach your goal weight. With Golo, you get an effective and affordable weight loss solution that's clinically proven, because controlling glucose, maintaining healthy insulin levels, and saying goodbye to starvation dieting is the secret to lasting weight loss and wellness. Visit Golo.com to get started today. That's Golo.com. Go to Golo.com to join the 5 million people who have switched to Golo as a better way to lose weight. Visit Golo.com today.